Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Professional Responsibilities and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 26, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will explore the recent Supreme Court case, Lee versus the United States, Effectiveness of Counsel. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of the Practice Group's Division at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Brian Frizzell, Appellate Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Laura Howell, Assistant Attorney General in the Alabama Attorney General's Office. To begin, I will turn it over to Brian. After his remarks, we will pass it along to Laura, and after they finish their beginning remarks, we'll move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Brian. The floor is yours.
Thank you, and good afternoon. We're here to talk about Lee v. United States, which was a recent decision by the Supreme Court. It's a case that involves the intersection of criminal law and immigration law, sometimes referred to as crimmigration law. The decision was issued on June 23rd, and so it was one of the last opinions to be issued this term, although it was argued in March before Justice Gorsuch joined the court, and so it was decided by an 8-justice court. So this case involves the Sixth Amendment, and specifically the portion of that amendment that guarantees criminal defendants the assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment says in relevant part that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have the assistance of counsel for his defense. And the Supreme Court has construed this to mean that criminal defendants must have effective assistance of counsel, which one can understand on an intuitive level. Just having someone officially assigned to you as your attorney doesn't mean that you're actually receiving the type of benefit that the Sixth Amendment provides for. So the question here is, how do you apply that guarantee, the guarantee of effective assistance of counsel, to a particular type of scenario where the defendant is not a citizen and conviction of a crime can lead not only to prison time but also to mandatory deportation? And just as a side note, in modern immigration law, the word removal is used in place of deportation, but we'll probably use both terms in our discussion. So here's the basic scenario. When a non-citizen is charged with a crime and obtains the help of an attorney, the situation will often proceed like this. In most instances, the defendant and the attorney will start to negotiate a plea deal with the prosecutors, which is how most criminal charges are resolved. And very often the government will offer a deal that would reduce the prison time that the defendant will serve compared with the amount of prison time he's likely to receive if convicted at trial. So that's the typical scenario. Here's the wrinkle. In some circumstances, the crime that the government wants the defendant to plead guilty to is what is called an aggravated felony under the immigration laws, which means that if the defendant is convicted of that crime, if he or she pleads guilty to that crime, he or she is subject to mandatory deportation. But in some instances, criminal defendants in this situation have received incorrect advice from their attorneys. In a case like this one, the attorney tells the client the opposite of the correct statement of the law, which is that he or she will not be deported if he accepts the plea deal. And the defendant takes the deal on that understanding, believing that by accepting the deal, he'll serve some prison time but won't be deported, and only later discovers that his attorney was wrong. So it has already been established by the Supreme Court that this type of mistake by an attorney is the kind of mistake that violates the Sixth Amendment. In other words, when an attorney misadvises his client about the immigration consequences of a criminal prosecution or the immigration consequences of accepting a plea, that defendant is not receiving effective assistance of counsel. And that was established in an important case called Padilla v. Kentucky, which was decided in 2010. And so when a defendant in that situation has been given incorrect advice by his attorney, the defendant can file a motion asking the court to vacate the plea and to vacate the conviction. And the claim in that situation is, if I had been properly advised, I would not have accepted the plea deal. I would have gone to trial and taken my chances, even though there is a risk that if I were convicted, I might have ended up with a longer prison sentence. Now, in some ways, that might seem like this would be the end of the story, because in this scenario, the defendant was denied the effective assistance of counsel. So one might think he would be able to vacate his conviction on that basis alone, but not so fast. That is not the governing law under the Supreme Court's precedent. In order to get out of a conviction in a scenario like this, based on a violation of your Sixth Amendment right to counsel, it's not enough just to show that your attorney's performance was deficient. And this comes from a decision called Strickland v. Washington, a 1984 decision, which is really the seminal case on ineffective assistance. So there are two requirements that a defendant in this situation has to satisfy. And the showing that one's attorney performed efficiently is just the first. You also have to show that you were prejudiced by the mistake. In other words, that you were actually harmed by the misadvice that your attorney gave you. So in some situations, there actually is a criminal trial, and an attorney makes a mistake during that trial. And that alone is not enough to vacate the conviction. The defendant will have to show that the mistake actually changed the outcome of the trial. In other words, if you would have been convicted anyway, the attorney's mistake doesn't really matter. And so the standard is you have to show there's a reasonable probability that, but for your attorney's mistake, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And in a decision called Hill v. Lockhart, the Supreme Court applied those standards to the scenario much like the one in this case, where a defendant does not actually go to trial and does not receive poor assistance during a trial, but the defendant accepts a guilty plea based on his attorney's mistaken advice. And so the basic standard is the same. You have to show that your attorney performed efficiently, and you still have to show prejudice. But the way that you show prejudice in this circumstance, according to the Supreme Court's prior cases, is that you have to show that but for your attorney's mistakes, you would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. So that's the basic landscape of the law that's the background for what happened in this case. So here, this case involved an individual named Jay Lee, who was brought to this country in 1982 from South Korea as a child with his parents. Has never been back to South Korea. Graduated high school here in the United States, has been a legal permanent resident the entire time he's lived here. For 20 years, has lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and eventually opened a restaurant and then a subsequent restaurant in Memphis. He had never previously been convicted of a crime, but it does appear that he became involved in drug activity. Police came across very strong evidence that he was dealing the drug ecstasy. And so they charged him with possession of that drug with intent to distribute it. So Lee obtained the assistance of an attorney, but his attorney informed him that he would not risk deportation if he accepted the plea deal that the government was offering him. And based on that assurance, Mr. Lee accepted the plea deal, and it was only later after he was serving his sentence that he learned that his attorney was wrong. So he obtained new counsel. He filed a motion under the federal habeas statute to vacate his conviction and his plea. Eventually, that claim went up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which denied his claim. We might touch on the reasoning of the decision a little more later, but the basic reasoning of the Sixth Circuit was that the evidence against Mr. Lee was overwhelming, and so if he had gone to trial, he almost certainly would have been convicted. And the circuit has adopted a rule for situations like this. And in the words of the circuit court, no rational defendant charged with a deportable offense who faces overwhelming evidence of guilt would proceed to trial rather than take a plea deal with a shorter prison sentence. And the court said that because Lee found himself in that situation, he had to lose the case, and he could not vacate his plea. So the question for the Supreme Court was, is that a sound rule? When a non-citizen defendant faces overwhelming evidence of guilt, can he nevertheless prove that his Sixth Amendment rights were violated? Is he allowed to try to show that despite the slim chances of acquittal that he had, he would actually have gone to trial if his counsel had properly informed him that accepting the plea deal would lead to deportation? So my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center, filed a brief in the Supreme Court that I co-authored in support of Mr. Lee. And the court reversed the decision below. It ruled for Mr. Lee, and it unequivocally rejected the rule that the Sixth Circuit had adopted. The opinion was written by Justice Roberts, and it was joined by all of the other justices except for Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, who wrote a dissent. And as I mentioned earlier, Justice Gorsuch did not participate in the case. So the basic problem with the rule adopted by the lower court, as Chief Justice Roberts explained, was that it wasn't really answering the question that the court was supposed to be asking in a situation like this. It was only considering one factor in the analysis, which was the likely outcome at the trial if Mr. Lee had gone to trial. But as the court explained, based on prior precedent, when a court is assessing whether a defendant was prejudiced, the court isn't supposed to look only at the likely outcome of the trial. And because the question from the Hill decision that I mentioned earlier, the question is whether, but for the attorney's mistakes, the defendant would have rejected the plea deal and would have gone to trial. The defendant doesn't need to make the additional showing that at this hypothetical trial that then would have happened, that he would have been acquitted or would likely have been acquitted. Now, the defendant's odds at that hypothetical future trial, they are significant, according to the court, but not in the way that the Sixth Circuit was treating them. They're significant because of how they would have affected the defendant's choice about whether to plead guilty or to go to trial. A defendant facing overwhelming odds of guilt has very strong incentives to cut a plea deal that might reduce prison time, as the court explained. But when you have a defendant who faces an additional penalty for the conviction, in this case being deported from the country where he's lived almost all of his life, a defendant in that situation might risk a slightly longer prison sentence for any chance of being acquitted at trial, even if it's a very small chance. That's the basic gist of Chief Justice Roberts' decision in the case. So my very quick take on the court's opinion, which I was, you know, of course, very pleased with because it aligned with the arguments that we made in our brief, was that I think in some ways this is a victory for common sense. I think that the rule adopted by the Sixth Circuit was a little bit irrational. It doesn't make sense logically and doesn't really fit with reality, in my view. On a more technical level, I think this was a victory for precedent and for stare decisis, the idea that you adhere to previous rulings, because I believe that the rule adopted by the lower court really deviated from the standards that the Supreme Court had laid down in prior cases, and I think that the court's recent decision explained why and sort of righted the ship. And I also think, most importantly, this was a victory for the fundamental liberties that the framers put in the Bill of Rights that protect us from governmental power. Again, the words of the Sixth Amendment say that in every criminal prosecution, the defendant should receive assistance of counsel. In this case, the Mr. Lee's counsel told him exactly the wrong statement of the law. He accepted this plea deal based on an assurance that it would not allow him to be deported. It was exactly the opposite of the truth. If that's not ineffective assistance of counsel, it's hard to see what would be, in my view. So the quick take from my perspective is that I think it was a very strong decision, very well explained by Chief Justice Roberts, which is not to say that the case did not involve some difficult issues, and I'm sure we'll talk about those as the conversation progresses.
Should I pick up there? Just wanted to say a quick thank you. Again, introduce myself. I'm Laura Howell, and wanted to say thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum and sort of picking up where Brian has just left off. I will say that I also wrote an amicus brief in this case on the opposite side, on the side that Justice Thomas wrote for when he wrote his dissent on behalf of himself and Justice Alito. But just to key back into the majority's opinion here for a second, first, I'll admit to always really enjoying reading Justice Roberts' writing, or Chief Justice Roberts' writing. He does make a very compelling case for why when a defendant has to quote from Hill, right, show a reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial, that means that and the buck stops there. Essentially, if the defendant would have gone to trial, would have said, let's take it to trial, basically that is prejudice for purposes of making an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. He does set out very clearly why that should be the case. But, you know, part of, I think a big part of what the dissent's point was, which, again, it takes the same language from Hill and says, well, I suppose let me back up for just a second. What neither side actually says is that there is sort of an ambiguity in the language of Hill, right? Strickland originally set out that to show ineffective assistance of counsel, you have to show that there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, but for the defense counsel's errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different, right? And then Hill v. Lockhart springs out from that and says, in the plea context, what you have to show is this, right? A reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, the defendant wouldn't have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. Hill purports to, spring from Strickland. It's consistent with the test that's articulated there. And so what Justice Thomas's point was in his dissent is that when you talk about a defendant taking their case to trial, you're talking about what they think is likely to happen at that trial. It's sort of baked in almost. When do you take a case to trial? When you think that you could do better than what you have in your plea. And so his analysis basically says, look, where you've got ambiguities in what Hill means, whether you think that it's nothing but the language on the page, right, the defendant's decision governs, or whether you think that you ought to be looking at the relevant potential, I guess, trial outcomes. excuse me. And I've gone off and lost my train of thought. Apologies. But where there is that ambiguity, we ought to be looking back at Strickland to help us clarify it, right? And so if Strickland is talking about an objective test and it's talking about looking at what the likely result of the proceeding would have been, then you do need to look at the fact that for, you know, this specific case's petitioner, Jay Lee, he didn't have a bona fide defense. He was looking at overwhelming evidence of guilt. And therefore, if we consider that the judge and or the jury in that case was a rational decision maker, then he would have been convicted at trial, which would just as surely have resulted in deportation as his plea bargain did. And so in Justice Thomas's dissent, you know, basically, there is no difference, and counsel's error didn't make a difference in the outcome of the proceeding. And as a result of that, there is no reason to go back and undo the plea bargain that had been done for, that had been signed by Lee in the first place. He talks, and this is a point that I think is of particular interest, for my boss, the state attorneys general, right, who oversee the administration of criminal justice systems in the states, which have, you know, even more criminal defendants than even the federal system does, which is where Lee himself was, that this has some major consequences for criminal justice systems. Where we thought that we accorded pleas a presumption of finality, this new decision that we have in Lee sort of undermines that to a certain extent. And some of the language in the majority opinion doesn't make clear that, just looking at the defendant's desires should be only done in cases where deportation is on the table, right? It's not clear if that should also apply to situations where, you know, the defendant was perhaps desperate to avoid registration as a sex offender, which is another sort of dire consequence that's sort of orthogonal to the fact of conviction. And so it sort of opens the door to a whole lot of potential plea deals being undone. And when those are 90% plus of the number of criminal convictions in this country, both in the state and federal systems, that's a pretty wide open door that you might be looking at a lot of undone pleas and a lot of prosecutors with a lot of new cases that they thought were long settled, you know, coming in front of courts, judges, juries, that are, you know, already overburdened. So I think it raises a lot of interesting potential challenges in the future. So I think that's my quick take on the case. Sorry, this is also my first time on a teleforum, so I'm not sure how to proceed forward.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you. Brian, would you like to take a moment to respond?
Sure.
Thank you.
So I think that was, a great articulation of the counterarguments set forth by Justice Thomas in his dissent, which echoed some of the reasoning in the Sixth Circuit's opinion as well. I mean, I do agree with the point that Laura made that the Hill v. Lockhart decision, there was an amount of ambiguity there, which is one reason that I was a bit nervous that this case was accepted by the court, because although this particular case involved a non-citizen who was facing deportation, I think as Laura mentioned, the implications are some of the implications are broader than that, because the Hill case, which is all about accepting a plea bargain, governs any criminal prosecution in which there's a plea bargain at play. And so there was potentially, I do agree, some ambiguity in the Hill decision about whether it's just enough to show that a defendant would have rejected a plea bargain, or whether there is an additional requirement to show that if the defendant had actually chosen to go to trial, that trial would have likely resulted in an acquittal. Definitely, however, I believe that the much better reading of Hill was that there is no secondary additional requirement like that. And I think there are good reasons for that, too. When you have a case like Strickland itself, where there actually was a criminal trial, and a defendant alleges that he received ineffective assistance during that trial, it's a manageable thing for a court to look at the record of the trial, to look at the mistake that the attorney made, and to assess whether that mistake actually likely affected the outcome or not. Because you have a real trial that took place, you have a record that you can examine. In a situation like this, though, there, of course, was no trial. And so if you're going to impose the additional burden on someone like Mr. Lee to show that he likely would have been acquitted at trial, you have to sort of look at the evidence that was in play when he was arrested and indicted, and you have to sort of imagine a hypothetical trial that never took place and how that would have played out given the facts that we know. It's extremely speculative, and, although I don't specialize in criminal law or criminal trials myself, I think it's probably not uncontroversial to say that you never exactly know what is going to happen at a criminal trial, even when the judge is doing his or her job correctly, when all of the jury members are faithfully carrying out their duty, even when the proceeding proceeds in exactly the way that it should be, in exactly the way that it should, you can't really ever say that there's no chance that the defendant would have been acquitted. And I think that was one of the problems with the sort of categorical rule that the Sixth Circuit had adopted, because essentially that rule said that if there's strong evidence against a defendant, then he or she would never reject a plea bargain that would reduce one's prison time. But I think if you even look at the record in this case, illustrates how easy it is to overestimate or to over speculate about the likelihood that the defendant would have been convicted, because there was an evidentiary hearing held after Mr. Lee filed his petition, and his own trial attorney testified at that hearing, and he said, I think his words were something to the effect of, it would have been an extremely difficult case to try, not impossible, but extremely difficult. And the district court, which looked at all this evidence, said that Mr. Lee almost certainly would have been convicted. Not certainly, but almost certainly would have been convicted. And if you read the Sixth Circuit's opinion, at various points in the opinion, it uses language like that acknowledges that there is the chance that he could have been acquitted. But at other points in the opinion, it uses language that suggests that he had absolutely no chance of being acquitted, and there's no possible way that he would have avoided his conviction. And to me, that sort of demonstrates the problem with the rule that the Supreme Court rejected in this decision. I think it's just too speculative to imagine the result of a hypothetical trial that never took place. And so that's one of the reasons that I thought it was a good decision by the court.
Let's go ahead and move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your phone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Looks like we have our first question. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
Hi, I guess my question is, under the Thomas Alito view, is it fair to say that someone against whom the evidence is overwhelming simply cannot establish, no matter how bad the tactical decision, that there was ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. When you say how bad the tactical decision, what you mean?
Well, I mean, generally, that's the question. It could be a guilty plea case. It could be a different kind of case. But there's always going to be the question of, what is the consequence? If the evidence is overwhelming, then it seems that it's unreviewable in this kind of context, and that he wouldn't be able to establish anything, regardless of. I mean, it's basically the appellate court, and this has happened in other cases like Requenco and Nieder and cases like that, that the appellate court can just look at the evidence and the constitutional right in question, no longer is presentable.
Well, I'm not sure that it's not presentable, but in any ineffective assistance claim, the question is whether, well, once you've gotten to the prejudice prong anyway, the question is whether the error that your counsel had made, right, which was they did something wrong, right, something that was not objectively reasonable. But the whole question is, did that actually affect the outcome of your proceeding? And if it's just a question of exchanging one guilty plea for, a guilty plea, I suppose, for a guilty verdict at trial, I think they would say that that's not a particularly good use of you know, judicial resources in particular, to go back just to accomplish the same thing a different way. Whereas if you had evidence, you know, even slightly less than overwhelming evidence, you would have some, perhaps grounds to say, look, if we had taken it to trial, this is a tact that we might have pursued at that point. You know, we might have tried to get this thrown out, or you know, to get this evidentiary ruling, you know, reversed. But the whole point, anytime that you're, you know, trying to negotiate a plea deal, is you're looking at what evidence the other side has against you, right? The likelihood of conviction, sort of at trial, against what they're offering you at present. And so I think they would say that, look, if you're sure that you're going to get a conviction at trial, you know, why wouldn't you take the plea and, I mean, essentially avoid the well, I know at least for me, if I were to be a criminal defendant, it would be an awful lot more stressful to go through a trial, if that answers your question.
And can I jump in too? I think I think the caller articulated it correctly. I do think that under the reasoning of Justices Thomas and Alito, it's a categorical rule. If there's overwhelming evidence against the defendant, that person can never succeed on an ineffective assistance claim, which in some ways boils down to the idea that when you have strong evidence against you, you aren't protected by the Sixth Amendment. That's, of course, an overstatement, but I don't think it's that much of an overstatement, which doesn't seem consistent with the language of the amendment, or, you know, what the framers were intending to achieve when they adopted it. And I think, you know, the consequences of that rule, they're pretty stark. If you imagine a defendant, a non-citizen defendant, who, let's say, is facing he's facing a felony that would lead to deportation, but relatively light possible prison sentence. So just imagine a 2-year possible prison sentence, and you know, the government offers a plea in which he will have to serve only 1 year. But nevertheless, after that year, he will be deported permanently from the country where he's lived, potentially for most of his life. It's hard to imagine that many defendants who knew about the actual consequences of their plea, who knew that accepting the plea would lead to deportation, it's hard to imagine that many of them, or at least it's hard to imagine that all of them, would accept a plea deal in that circumstance. I think many people would accept the risk of an extra year in prison if it meant getting to actually spend the rest of their lives in this country with, you know, potentially their family. In this case, for instance, Mr. Lee, you know, had two parents who live in this country who are U.S. citizens, who are pretty elderly. He's the only child that they have who could help take care of them. And so I think one can easily understand why someone in his situation would be willing to go through the risk of getting a longer sentence, even a longer sentence of several years, in order to avoid you know, the harsh penalty of being separated from his family and from this country permanently. I mean, in this case...
Go ahead.
I was just one last point. In this case, you know, he faced a sentence of, I believe he could have been sentenced to up to 5 years if he had been convicted at trial, and the plea deal enabled him to serve only 1 year. I mean, that's pretty good, but compared with being banished from the country for the remainder of his life, I think a lot of people would make the decision that he did, which is to try to, you know, avoid deportation at all costs.
Well, and that's certainly understandable, but the whole point is that if he goes to trial, he will still be convicted of that same offense, right? And he will still face deportation. It will just be at the end of a longer prison sentence. It doesn't actually do anything in furtherance of making him more able to stay with his family, because even if he remains in the United States, he will remain incarcerated for an additional 4 years. in a way, it seems almost like false hope has been given here, because if Mr. Lee goes to trial and there is overwhelming evidence, and we assume that the judicial system, you know, is full of rational actors, because I think because we have to, then we assume that overwhelming evidence plus no bona fide defense equals a guilty verdict against Mr. Lee. And that just as surely leads to deportation, as does his guilty plea.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that that's, you know, that's the strength of the counter argument, that the defendant who does go to trial may end up being deported either way, just after serving a longer prison sentence. But I think, I think my response to that goes back to what I mentioned earlier, which is that we can assume that he would have been convicted at trial, but it's really difficult to say, I think, that we can know for a fact that he would have been convicted. And for that reason, you know, he should have the chance to take his chances and exercise his right to a jury trial. I mean, I do think it's worth noting that I alluded to this earlier, but you know, the very idea that a defendant needs to show prejudice in the first place, it's not something that's actually written in the Sixth Amendment. It's something that the Supreme Court devised when it was trying to figure out how to implement this amendment. One can make a pretty good argument, I think, that if you are the Sixth Amendment says that in all criminal proceedings, the accused still have the right to assistance of counsel. And one can make the argument, and I think these arguments were made back in the 80s, that if you are deprived of your constitutional right to assistance of counsel, that proceeding was invalid and the conviction should be vacated. The Supreme Court adopted a much more restrictive approach when it decided Strickland, and said that you also have to show that you were prejudiced by the attorney's mistake. And so I think that's all the more reason not to extend that prejudice requirement even further to a situation like this one, in my view.
We have three questions pending. Let's move to our next question.
Hello, Ms. Harrell. It's Mary Maxwell here in Tuscaloosa. I'm the author of a book called Marathon Bombing. It's about the trial of Jahar Sarnaev in, I think, 2015. And he had a public defender. It's a U.S. court, called Judy Clark, and her first opening words at his trial were, "It was him." I'm not abbreviating or interpreting what she said. Those were her three words, "It was him." And so I and everyone else assumed he had pleaded guilty, naturally, but that's not true. He never pleaded guilty. And I suppose you would say now, based on what I just heard you say, and by the way, I've never known of the Strickland case until today, so I'm very glad I belong to the Federalist Society. But would you agree that a jury couldn't have walked back into that room, you know, a month later, whatever it was, and said he's not guilty when his defender opened her remarks with "it was him"? Now, by the way, I think it was said she was trying out a strategy whereby she would get the jury into a good mood by showing that the boy himself agrees he did it, but then he was going to blame the now deceased brother as being like the mastermind or something. But no matter what, she did say it was him, and he was pleading not guilty.
I could start. I mean, I'm not familiar with that case. It certainly sounds like a remarkable situation. To me, that sounds like it fits perfectly within the original Strickland decision. In that case, as you were describing it, you know, there was a trial, and if the defendant had pled not guilty, it certainly sounds, based on your description, like for his attorney to assert that he was guilty would not have been a defense strategy that met the standards that the Supreme Court says are required by the Sixth Amendment. So, sort of interesting. I think that fits more in with the traditional kind of ineffective assistance case, you know, as in the Strickland example, as opposed to a case like this one that involved a plea bargain.
Yes, and And I would agree, certainly, because you would have to ask, well, if the attorney had said anything different, something different, if they had tried any other strategy, would that have made a difference in the jurors' minds? Again, you have to look at the totality of the evidence, and I don't know any of the specifics of that case, but I do think that that falls more in line with the traditional Strickland inquiry than it does with what was confronted here in Lee.
Let's move to our next question.
Lee now knows that he's going to be deported whether he accepts the plea or not. So he goes back, and the government puts the same plea on the table, and his counsel tells him, you can take the plea and serve one, or you can go to trial, you will almost certainly be convicted, and you can serve five, and in each case, you will almost certainly be deported. Can Lee take the deal? And second, you know, going forward, what if... is it counsel's job to say you can take the plea and you almost certainly will be deported? You can try your case. You will almost certainly be deported if you're convicted. Is that adequate?
So taking those questions in reverse order, let me give them a shot. I think the responsibility on counsel is to correctly advise the client of the potential consequences. And so I think if an attorney presents his opinion to his client that that there's virtually no chance of acquittal, and therefore that deportation is almost inevitable. I think and therefore recommends accepting a plea that would reduce the prison time. I'm not sure that would be an effective assistance of counsel. I mean, I think the client in that case would have been properly informed. And then it would really be up to the client to, weigh his personal circumstances and his sort of risk aversion, I guess. It might be different clients, I think, who are in different scenarios might answer that question very differently, depending on things like how long they've been in the U.S., whether they have any connection to the country that they might be deported to. Now, like in this case, for instance, Mr. Lee had never been back to South Korea. And there are other cases that have come up around the country where individuals have been deported to countries where they don't even speak the language because they were brought here as, very young children. So I think, different defendants who are given proper advice by their attorneys, will take that advice and have the right to weigh their options. So I don't think it necessarily would be problematic at all for an attorney to lay out his or her assessment in that way. With respect to what might happen with Mr. Lee, there are other possibilities. One is that we don't know exactly what the prosecution will do now that Mr. Lee has had the original plea vacated. They could try to charge him for the same crime, or potentially they could, to save themselves the trouble of having to go to trial and to prove this case, especially given that a number of years have passed, they could offer him a different plea that might or might not involve a longer prison sentence, but might involve a crime that would not lead to deportation. That's one of the options. And that's a point that some of the amicus briefs in this case supporting Mr. Lee emphasized, that even if a defendant might not stand a good chance at trial, when he's properly advised about deportation consequences, his attorney could try to negotiate with the government to work out a deal that might involve even more prison, but would keep the defendant in the United States if that's the most important thing to him or her. So I think it's hard to say exactly what will happen or what happened. I think it's notable that I forget the exact year that Mr. Lee was arrested, but it has been at least 5 or 6 years, and he finished his 1 year prison sentence a long time ago, and the entire time since then, he's been sitting, incarcerated on the hopes of being able to vacate his plea. He has not, you know, allowed himself to be deported, which I think in some ways, you know, illustrates the degree to which some criminal defendants will be willing to take any chance, no matter how small it might seem, to remain in this country by going to trial, even when the deck is stacked against them.
Yeah, and, well, and I apologize. Were you about to ask another question? I'm sorry.
Could the government offer him time served in deportation or more time in deportation?
Well, so the prosecutors are not actually the ones that make the determinations about deportation.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, which is why counsel would say you're almost certainly going to be deported. I don't have any hand in your deportation. Defense counsel doesn't, prosecutor doesn't, but it's a deportable offense, deportable conviction, either way.
And I'm sorry, so what was the question at?
Assume it's a deportable conviction either way. Could the government just say time served in deportation?
You know, I honestly don't know. That's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer.
I wouldn't think anything would stop them from offering that deal. I think the real question would be how likely it would be to be accepted. And
I was going
to
say,
the
court has said he's entitled to a trial.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If I were him, I would choose the trial option at that point.
I think in this particular case, we can be pretty sure that he would not accept a deal like that, given the lengths to which he has gone to try to avoid deportation.
Thank you.
Thank you for your questions. To ask another question, please enter star, then pound on your phone. In the meantime, while we wait, want to announce that the next teleforum by the Federalist Society will be tomorrow, July 27th at noon, regarding the Internet of Things with the Regulatory Transparency Project. The next Practice Groups Federalist Society teleforum conference call is scheduled for Friday, July 28th at noon. That call will be regarding developments on overtime at the Department of Labor and will feature Tammy McCutcheon, shareholder at Littler Mendelson. Just a reminder, please keep an eye out for these emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. You can find all this information on our website, as well as any podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls. Would our experts like to give any closing remarks?
I'll make one final remark. I think I think there are valid concerns that Laura raised earlier in the call about how wide-ranging the effects of this decision will be on future cases. I think that one interesting aspect of the decision is that I think to some extent it placed some limits on what is required of a defendant in order to vacate a plea in a situation like this. It made very clear that it's not good enough for a defendant to simply say that he or she would have rejected the plea. The court said that the lower courts should look for contemporaneous evidence, from the time that the plea was being negotiated, that substantiate the defendant's claim. And so I think it remains to be seen, you know, how many defendants will be able to vacate their pleas based on this decision and how widespread the impact will be.
Yeah, and along those lines, Brian frames them, you know, as limits. And I do agree that there are some limits that are placed on defendants that are seeking to overturn their convictions in this way. But I will also, you know, just register that it will be interesting to see in the future how this does come to affect the criminal justice system and what we see prosecutors doing both at, you know, the state, local levels as well as at the federal level as they are negotiating plea deals or contemplating doing so with non-citizen defendants because this does, it changes the game a little bit if you run into, you know, I cannot think of a non-citizen defendant that wouldn't be very, very interested in avoiding deportation if that were at all possible. And so it will be interesting to see how willing they are to negotiate these plea bargains that might or might not be upset by courts in the future, who are not at all certain of their finality going forward. So.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. And thank you all very much for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.